The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Food riots in Egypt and Haiti. Food prices are soaring. The price of rice has jumped by about half in the past year. The use of food stamps, there was an editorial today in America, is up sharply. The price of vegetable oil has doubled. Population has continued to increase, but growth of the global food supply has slowed. World leaders met in Rome last week to discuss rising food prices and growing food shortages. Companies like Monsanto are aiming to win acceptance of genetically modified crops by showing that they can play a major role in feeding the world. There are rising concerns about food safety. Those meatballs at the church picnic might make you very sick. The environmental impact of industrialized agriculture suggests that the true costs of cheap calories are unsustainably high. Tonight, we're going to hear about some of those issues as we discuss food in both a global and a local perspective. We'll hear about California's innovative food community and the possible solutions they've come up with. First tonight, we're going to hear, as I mentioned, from author and journalist Paul Roberts, who writes and lectures frequently on the complex interplay of economics, technology, and the natural world. We had a great panel when Paul was here for The End of Oil, and tonight, again, it's centered around his book, The End of Food. Paul Roberts has written for the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian in the UK, as well as the New Republic, Newsweek, Rolling Stone, and Outside, and many other publications. I predict the panel around this subject tonight will be just as lively as the one when Paul was last here. After Paul speaks, we'll hear from filmmaker farmer Lisa Brennis, who is a self-described drought-tolerant California native. Lisa grows organic citrus, including the delicious pixie tangerines, with her husband, Jim Churchill, in Ojai, California. She recently finished her first feature-length video documentary, Eat It Bill's Life in the Monterey Market. Lisa supports her movie habit by writing technical reference books for Peach Pit Press, and so if you need to know about Final Cut Pro, she's the go-to person. After Lisa shows her presentation of her film, she will be joined by the rest of our panel, wonderful panel, Bill Fujimoto, who is the subject, among other aspects of farming, of Lisa's film. Bill is a graduate of UC Berkeley, and he joined his parents' Berkeley store, the Monterey Market, after working 5 years as a mechanical engineer at Lockheed. Founded in 1962, Monterey Market is an independent market specializing in fresh produce in season. And if you are going up to Berkeley, California, you must not miss a stop at the Berkeley Market. Monterey Market has grown up with the food revolution in Northern California and has a strong commitment to supporting local agriculture and sustainable farming practices. Bill Fujimoto was a founding member of the San Francisco Ferry Plaza Market Collaborative. And moderating our panel will be Evan Kleiman, renowned owner and executive chef of one of LA's favorite restaurants, certainly one of mine, Angeli Cafe, and best-selling author of numerous cookbooks, including Cucina Fresca and Pasta Fresca. We also have copies of those for sale tonight, at least Cucina Fresca. Evan's been the host of Good Food on KCRW since 1998. She's a scholar of Italian cooking and culture, an avid gardener, and an admired teacher and chef. In addition to her restaurant and writing pursuits, Evan serves on the board of directors of the Hollywood Farmers Market and on the board of overseers of the Chefs Collaborative 2000, organizations which are both devoted to educating the public on issues of sustainability. Without further ado, please welcome Paul Roberts to the Los Angeles Public Library and enjoy the panel and the rest of the night.
Thank you, Louise. Can everyone hear me who wants to? So thank you for the warm introduction and the warm welcome. It's a privilege to be back here. I was here in 2004 discussing this book I'd written called The End of Oil. Now I'm back with The End of Food, and so it's, you know, what's this guy's problem? My kids are pretty disappointed. My son, who's 11, says, Dad, when are you going to write a book with a title that makes people want to buy the book? You know, his suggestion is The Beginning of Cake, all right? So why the end of food? You know, I mean, right now with food prices soaring, it does sort of feel like we're at the end of food. At least you kind of get that sense. But I began writing the book before the food price spike. And really what I was referring to in the title was the end of our confidence in food. You know, we're kind of emerging from a kind of a golden era in food production. I mean, if you think about it, for much of the last century, most of the news from the food front was good news. You know, we could produce more food more cheaply. It was safer. It was more convenient. It was better, and it got better every year, or seemed to. And this sort of steady improvement created an expectation that that's how things were going to be. And this our food progress sort of became an index, a marker for our larger prosperity and progress. And I think that what's happened in the last 20 years is that even mainstream consumers are sort of waking up to the fact that it's no longer the golden era, and it may never have been, and that we're losing ground in a lot of areas. We're seeing, you know, we've got still a billion people who can't get enough to eat. Now we have a billion people who are overnourished, to use the politically correct term. We have lots of concerns about the diet, you know, the nutritional content of the food we're eating, the junk food we're eating, but also the declining nutritional content in the fresh fruits and produce. There's less vitamins and minerals in the things we're growing today. Then, of course, we have even worse things in the food. We have various pathogens. You know, E. coli is now apparently a routine news story now. You know, E. coli in the meat supply, E. coli in the fresh produce. And then, of course, we were surprised to discover, most of us, not only that we were importing a lot of food from China, but then a sizable fraction of it should have stayed in China or should have actually been disposed of before it got here. And, you know, taken by themselves, we've been aware of a lot of these stories for some time. I think what is beginning to occur to people is that there's a relationship between these problems, that they're connected, and that they're actually symptomatic of a food system that is really overheating, a food system that's built on an unsustainable base, and in my view, a food system that's really being driven by a flawed premise. And that premise is this: we thought that we could produce food just like we produce anything else. We thought that we could take the same technologies and industrial processes and business practices from the, you know, automotive industry and consumer electronics and the toy business, and we could apply them to food and we'd have good results. And I think what we're discovering is that you can push food so far. You can rationalize and industrialize and make efficient only so far before food begins to fight back. It resists. And it resists sometimes in really serious ways. So you start looking around, you look at this model, and you say, well, let's say I was going to manufacture cars. Well, it would make sense to centralize my production in a handful of massive plants with huge output at each plant. And it would make sense to find my raw materials as cheaply as possible from whichever suppliers happen to be selling them at the best price that day. Okay? And it would make sense to manufacture these things rapidly and to distribute them rapidly and get them to consumers rapidly before the consumers had a chance to change their minds, right? I mean, this is the model of industrial production in the modern age. But you apply this to food and problems begin to creep in. You know, for example, let's say you're the world or the country's largest ground beef producer, for example. And you discover that your workers have inadvertently mixed two batches from one day to the next. And further, you discover there's a little E. coli in one of those batches. Well, now the stuff is gone. It's not only gone, you have no idea where it is in your system. In fact, so ignorant are you of where it might be that you have to recall everything, all 23 million pounds of hamburger. And the recall is so massive that you have to go out of business. Now, I got to ask you, is this a sustainable model? You know, that a system is pretty much guaranteed to have a contaminant intrude. The only remedy is to you know, recall the entire product line, and the only consequence of the remedy is to go out of business. And this model is not unique to the meat business. You'll find this model in every part of the food sector. So, or consider our drive for low-cost food. I mean, you know, getting cheap calories has been sort of a human obsession for a long time. This is why we survived, and we're very good at it. But Along about the 1980s, it became an obsession with some real negative consequences. You know, the big end users like Walmart and McDonald's, they have such massive market share that they can tell their suppliers not only what kinds of products to sell them, but at what price. And these suppliers have very little choice but to basically turn themselves inside out trying to lower their costs. And so they do it in all sorts of ways that you're familiar with. They automate, they consolidate, make huge plants. But they also adopt some practices that are less savory. For example, they start hiring or simply bringing in a lot of illegal immigrants. This is, you know, in the meat industry in particular. Every week you pick up the newspaper and there's a story about another bust at another Hormel plant. And this is really how they keep costs low. Or they begin buying their raw materials from the low-cost producer. You know, this is how we ended up in China, getting wheat gluten and soy protein that were contaminated with melamine. And you think about the China story. I mean, in hindsight, what were we thinking exactly? You know, here's a country, an economy, that's infamous for exporting low-quality consumer products like televisions and toys and clothes and lawn furniture. But we thought it would be okay to have China make our food for us. I mean, where exactly is the logic there? And China is trying desperately to improve its system. You know, they are not blind to what's going on, but China is where we were 100 years ago when Sinclair wrote The Jungle. You know, a rapidly expanding, industrializing food sector and a regulatory system that's way, way behind. And it's in this gap where the problems begin. So we've identified the problems, but we're still sourcing food from China. And you can take this critique of the low-cost model and you can apply it across the food sector. And you can see all kinds of problems creeping in. You know, if you look at the safety record, if you look at declining nutritional standards, a lot of it has to do with the fact that we're trying to produce food as if it were any other consumer product. And the truth is that it's not. And until we recognize that, we will repeat these mistakes again and again. Now, in terms of solving this, one of the classic problems that we face is that we're still insisting on dealing with these problems separately, discreetly. We'd like to imagine that the food system is separate from the other sectors of the economy. I would think that the biofuels debacle would have cured us of that. I mean, you know, what we were going to do with biofuels was we were going to solve the energy crisis by taking all this acres that we apparently weren't using and creating fuel, and we'd be off, you know, cure our addiction to Middle Eastern oil and everything would be fine. Well, think about what we've done here. We've taken the food sector, which as far as I'm concerned is the most important sector on the planet, and we have linked it in a very firm way to the most volatile commodity on the planet, oil, a commodity that's not only volatile but whose, you know, price trend forecast is this way. We've linked food to a commodity whose price is only going to go up, and we're kind of wondering, I guess that didn't work. And again, you look through the food system, you realize that in case after case, a solution, because it wasn't thoroughly mapped out, becomes another problem. We've done this repeatedly. Well, one of the classic cases in the late 1940s, we discovered that if you fed animals antibiotics, what would happen? They got bigger in a hurry. And it's interesting, this was discovered by fishermen in New York State. They were fishing the Hudson River just about an hour outside of the city, and their fish were getting bigger every year. And normally, fishermen don't complain about big fish, but because these ones were being hooked downstream from a pharmaceutical company, there was some concern it might not be an entirely natural phenomenon. And lo and behold, one of the scientists at the company discovered that if you fed even small amounts of antibiotics to baby chicks, they would get 25% bigger on the same feed. And you could do this with turkeys, pigs, anything. And cows would give more milk, and sows would give more, you know, have more pigs per litter and larger birth weights. And, you know, and it was on the same feed. And coming after World War II, when we were short of meat in this country, meat prices were high, and worldwide there was a serious and near fatal meat shortage, this seemed like a miracle. It seemed like free meat. And it was an example of how science had solved one of humanity's biggest problems. I mean, for 6,000 years we'd been short of meat. All of a sudden we had it in abundance. And antibiotics, feeding livestock antibiotics, was one of the key drivers to the livestock revolution, which, you know, increased output geometrically and drove down cost. Now, as we know, there have been some serious consequences to feeding antibiotics to livestock. One is that the livestock industry is entirely dependent on antibiotics. Half of all antibiotics manufactured on the planet are fed to animals that we eat. The other big problem is that we've created, by trying to kill all the pathogens that inhabit livestock, we've missed some, and they have reproduced, and now we've created an army of pathogens that are resistant to our strongest antibiotics. So we're facing the prospect of going backward to an era when we could not cure our child's earache or other infectious diseases, which is really scary. I mean, there's very few people in this room, I would imagine, that have had to contemplate that kind of reality, and yet we may be facing that. Now, here's the beauty part. The industry, the meat industry, recognizes that this is a problem. They may have made a mistake. And they're saying, fine, consumers don't want to eat antibiotics in their meat. Okay, well, we'll stop feeding, you know, antibiotics to our livestock. And here the problem is that animals, because they haven't changed the rest of the way the animals are being raised, they're still in crowded conditions. They're still passing infections back and forth, you know, like a firestorm. And animals that get sick, they get smaller. Okay, they're not doing well. They can't use all the calories. They're using calories to fight off infections, so they don't put on bone and meat fast. So they get small. They get centered. They're kind of reversing the progress of the antibiotics provided in the first place. And the problem here is that because we've so automated the processing process, you know, we use machines that take care of a lot of things that we don't want to do by hand anymore. And those machines are, I'm sorry, I hope that no one had chicken tonight. Well, it's tough to talk about food without talking about food, but the machines that process chickens are designed for chickens of a certain size and weight. They need uniformity. And when they encounter a bird that is small or the wrong shape, they will often cut it the wrong way, with the result being that what was inside the bird is now outside the bird and on everything around the bird, other birds, workers, and machinery. And if that bird was ill, say no more, which may explain, a lot of experts think this is one of the reasons behind the rise in the incidence of pathogens like salmonella that are on the chicken and turkey that you find in your store. We had been dropping that number down through the 90s and early 2000s. It's now coming back up in a significant trend. Here's an example of how one solution led to a problem, which we tried to solve, which led to another. So now the industry says, okay, well, fine. Now we get it. The Pew Charitable Trust just released a long report where they critique the meat industry, and the meat industry actually agrees that they should phase out factory farming. And we're going to, maybe in the next 10 to 20 years, we'll go back to raising animals in a much more sustainable and maybe even a humane way, with the exception of that little end process. And the challenge there is that many of the practices that we're going to be getting rid of are the very practices that let us drive the price of meat down in the first place. So our meat's going to be much more expensive. Now, try telling that to a nation or a world that now thinks food is too expensive. And you see the political problem here. It doesn't mean it's insurmountable. It just means that it's very tough. Now, I've just chosen one example of where a problem had unintended consequences. We tried to fix those, and still more unintended consequences came up. But that is really the story of the food system. And until we begin approaching this comprehensively, this is what we're going to encounter. We will continue to create more problems than as soon as we solve them. Now, I've been given exactly 15 minutes to go over the entire... Yeah, I have 30 seconds left. So my sort of objective here was twofold, not just tonight, but in the book. The idea was to sort of lay out in economic terms, because people have been preached to about their food for too long, and people have a habit of just kind of turning it down. But if I could make the case, the economic case for why the system doesn't work and the economic case for radically transforming the system, it seemed to me that consumers and policymakers would come to my conclusions on their own. I wouldn't need to beat them there. They could come there on their own. And the next step, though, after you've sort of laid out the problems, is sort of coming up with solutions. And we have to break the mindset that says you have to produce en masse, you have to produce cost, you know, super cost effectively, and cheapness is the deciding factor. Cheapness is the index for success. Because what we're learning is that, you know, in food, there's a threshold below which you can't go. You just can't go, and you shouldn't go. Now the question is, how do we back up from that? And tonight, I think what we're going to be talking about with the panel, and I hope you'll join in, is once we've identified the problems, what are some of the ways that we as consumers can take action here? Because I know for a fact that, you know, many of us feel completely disempowered. We can see the system's going awry. You know, if it's not fuel costs, it's food costs. And yet, we feel completely alienated from the system, many of us. And what will be really great about this panel is that there are people here whose kind of whole mission in life is to reattach people with their food. So without further ado, I'm going to shut up, and we're going to watch a little bit of Bill's film, and then we'll start the panel. So thanks very much for your attention.
Hi. I'm Lisa Brennis, and I want to thank Louise for inviting me to come down and show a little bit of my movie. I'm just going to set up what you're seeing very briefly so you know why a person who makes films and grows tangerines would make a movie about a guy who has a grocery store. Or why would you make a movie about a grocery store? Okay, thank you. I'm glad you asked. I will try to be brief, and any of you who have ever talked to someone who's made a small film or run a small farm, you know that that's always a long story. When you go, so how'd you get started, you know, an hour later? So I'm going to try to make this short. Let's see. I worked here in Los Angeles. I was in the kind of the small end of the television and movie business, and I met Jim, and he was working in the small end of the television movie business when he was not running to Ojai to tend this failing avocado orchard. But I married him anyway. And back in 80, he had some failing avocados, and he found this great-tasting obscure tangerine at a friend's packing house and planted some out. And then 10 years later, we had a crop, and he set out to sell this crop and came down to Los Angeles and had no takers, none, zero. No one was interested in an unknown fruit. I had grown up in Berkeley, California, and my high school friend said, you really ought to try this guy Bill Fujimoto over at the Monterey Market because he's your guy. So we sent some fruit up to Bill. Bill liked the fruit. Jim gets on the phone with him, and again, long story short, he wound up making the largest order that we had ever sold by, I don't know what, a factor of 10. He explained how to get a truck to stop at our farm, basically became our mentor, our godfather, in the art of direct selling, which has enabled us to, 20 years later, still be selling tangerines happily. And this is a great story, and it's kind of an invisible story. I think you could shop at the Monterey Market for 20 years and maybe not know what's going on there. So I made this little movie. Evan Kleiman, Bill Fujimoto.
Company. I have to say that the first time I watched Lisa's film, I was filled with such a sense of pure joy and happiness. And I read a lot of books on sustainable subjects, and I watch a lot of documentaries, and it's easy to tune things out, as Paul said, and to feel a little jaded. And if you have a chance to watch this film in its entirety, you will smile from the first frame to the last. I think Bill is a little uncomfortable with his newfound fame. But I think he needs to get used to it, because what he has created up there at Monterey Market is an externalization of his pure joy at the connection between producers and consumers. And it's something that many of us strive to do a couple times a week when we go to the farmers market, and to see someone whose life is so completely centered around this is wonderful. And Lisa managed to just capture it completely. Before I start with questions for Bill and for Lisa, I wanted to ask Paul, did that make you feel a little better?
No. It did. It's just great to see people doing that for real, you know, not just talking about it, but doing it. So, bravo. That was great.
Now, Bill, I know that your dad had the store before you did. Now, when he had the store, did he buy direct from farmers, or did he buy from large produce distributors?
Well, actually, he came from a different time when there was direct marketing to the wholesale market. So when you went to the wholesale market, you'd see farmers. The whole distribution system has changed now, such that for mainstream agriculture, production goes to large-scale distribution, to packing sheds, and so you never see the actual producers. But he had that connection at one point. He had been a wholesaler, a farmer, and a retailer.
Talk a little bit about this change in distribution, because like downtown here, I remember going to the produce market and you would see individual farmers one after another, and the trucks would come and fill up with 10 cases from this farmer, 20 from the other, 20 from the other. It's very different now, isn't it?
Well, of course. Most products are go through supermarket chains and come from many miles away. To be productive, farms have to be hundreds of acres, truckloads of products of the same product. But within that system, our store runs on with these more local connections that we try to cultivate. We use that distribution system. We use those trucks, but we put like one pallet or two pallets or four pallets on a truck heading east, west, north, or south towards us, and we pick up at the terminal point. So we depend on that, on the supermarket distribution system, but we work inside of it. Where the drivers will work on for single lots.
So you sort of hitchhike on to excess capacity.
Yes, exactly. And there's always going to be excess capacity because there's in the food distribution, it's not programmed that well. So,
What percentage of the truckers who are hauling around produce in California are independent?
I really can't answer the question. I really don't know.
Lots? A little?
Within my visibility, there's always truckers available. That is, people. I have one friend in the wholesale business who will find a truck, who will put a truck under a load I'm trying to get.
Because I've heard a lot of people discuss that one of the big obstacles to doing what you do on in other parts of the country or on a wider basis is this difficulty. Of transportation.
There's no question. Half of my job in terms of purchasing is finding products that I want, and the other, it's sometimes almost half the job is getting delivered, whether it's piggybacked on a farmer coming into a farmer's market or a direct delivery in trucks or getting it put on a common carrier. You know, obviously common carrier is the most efficient way of doing it.
Give us an example of what that would be for those of us who don't know the lingo.
That's how our Pixie Tangerines get to Bill's store.
Yeah. Yes, you saw in this movie Judith from Full Belly Farm. She had her own truck, and she has typically maybe 4 or 5 pallets worth of product that allows her to just jump in that truck and drive down. She comes down from maybe 150 miles away. I don't know what the freight costs are, but they're significant. For oranges coming from North County, San Diego, or Ojai, then you want to put them on a common carrier. So for a flat rate, it will arrive in Oakland at the Oakland Terminal Market at 2:00 in the morning.
And then do you have people go to Oakland and pick everything up?
I go every morning. Yeah,
Seem sustainable to me.
My day starts at 2:00 in the morning. You know, between 1, 2, and 3 is when I do that kind of just shipping kind of, you know, meeting trucks, knowing what's on it.
So it's your bedtime now, right?
What's that?
It's your bedtime now.
Actually, the day starts about noon or so. I go home and actually put on the PJs and go back to sleep until about 5 or 6.
Wow.
And then I.
Do you? When I watched the film, it was staggering to me how much product you sell, how quickly it comes in, and how quickly it comes out. Because there are scenes in the movie of being in the back with chefs, and you can barely fit through the stacks of produce. And man, people are almost fighting over the specialty things. Do you ever have waste? Do you ever have things that you need to send to a food bank?
Of course, there's lots of waste, but you you know, it's a, you know, I don't claim to be anything more than a retailer. You know, if you buy something, you got to sell it. And I don't want to be, I don't want to say something I'm not. But in fact, once you get that kind of business, you know, the business is about flow, that you're trying to get your customer to come back. So you try to make sure they're happy when they leave, or they're happy with what they get. And in that sense, that's why I left my previous career. You need that kind of flow, and once you develop that flow, then you can have the traffic that we do.
There is something that because the market's very well established, and because there's a strong loyal customer base, Bill and the farmers and his customers together in this project can pursue a higher risk game in pursuit of flavor, which means that Bill can ask the growers to leave the cherries on the tree a day or two longer so they're really mature. And then so the farmer takes a risk, because every day it's on the tree and not in the market, you know, you risk something can happen. Bill takes delivery and knows he's got to turn it, you know, because stuff that's at full flavor doesn't last, like the more shelf-stable kind of flavorless stuff. So his risk is that he's going to take massive quantities and it's going to go, it's going to move. And the customers come and know that they can't buy this fully mature stuff and let it sit around. You got to eat it. But if everybody does their part, you know, and it's also all having to do with seasonality, right? Like right now, it's, you know, we're getting into the good part of cherry season, and you know there are these huge flows, and everybody's kind of in the project and going like, cherries, all right, let's get to work, you know.
and part of that is being an eater of cherries. And one of the things that fascinated me about your story, and what I think is the difficult aspect of it to replicate it, is the education of the consumer. And to get the consumer to completely buy in to each seasonal personality, so that they're like, these fruits are like little mini celebrities in a way in these people's lives, and they come waiting for them to arrive. People who drive up and are there at 8 in the morning, because they know if they come later, everything's going to be gone.
Well, maybe things will disappear. The park,
parking,
it's they're on. So they can get a parking place. But the point's well taken, is that if you emphasize seasonality, then you will see things come and go. Boysenberries are happening right now, and they will be gone in a week, the week or two, because the best boysenberries come when it's hot, not when it's, you know, not the ones from Oregon that are not picked during season. But my point is there's seasonality. So if you emphasize seasonality within the store, you know, the best peaches will come and go. Masamoto's Suncrest will come, and they will go. You know, there are raspberries right now that will come and will go. And
how much of the beginning part of your, when you made the, when you decided to make the switch from mechanical engineering, which I just, you must have been so miserable.
Actually, I loved the work. I hated the job.
I understand that.
I used to build computer models. So.
And sort of what you do is you can see your joy in the flow, sort of having that experience.
Well, in there, no day, no week at this. When you walk through the front door, you should be able to tell within a month what the time of the year is, and just by walking through the front entrance to the store, just because it's seasonal.
I want to add something though, because Bill may not get to it, and I think it's critical. It is a critical difference between this store and other places that I've seen, and I think it's integral to its success. And that is that any person in that store can tell you, you know, what kind of potato you should buy if you are, you know, boiling, mashing, making French fries. Anybody moving boxes, you know, can point at a pluot.
So the level of education.
So when you say educating the consumer, the way that I see it happening at Bill's stores, there are no consumers, there are customers, and everything is done one-on-one conversationally. And then pretty soon the customers start telling each other, you know, because it's Berkeley and everybody's just insufferable. So, but in a fun way, you know. But that is that's one of the things that just made me on fire to finish this movie, was because I really think that level of just talking to people in the place where they go and buy their food anyway, the regular place where regular people buy their food most of the time, and just being in a position to say, that's really the best apple in the store today, you know, because it's in season, or because it's, you know, this guy's incredible, or, you know.
Well, yeah. Also, remember, when it's in season, it's also in production. It's also the cheapest.
Yeah. And these guys, you know, pass the breaks along. And that has a big impact on people's buying habits. You know, when strawberries are in full flood, boy, you can really, you know.
You know, the point is that if you explain to your employees that this is why you, I like to say that there's a reason why you're selling everything in the store. And so everyone in each section has to know why they're selling this. You know, why are you selling, you know, so if a customer comes up and says, why are you selling this? You should have an answer. And just that would kind of translates into being seasonal.
I saw these beautiful jicamas in there 2 weeks ago. I mean, usually you don't think of a jicama and beautiful in the same sense, but these were the color of palominos, and they were shiny. I've never seen a shiny jicama. I said, those are beautiful jicamas, to the guy who's like unloading the boxes. You know, he whips out a knife. He goes, that's because they just came in and this is jicama season. You know.
I mean, who ever heard that sentence before?
Exactly. And I thought, and I've been hanging around that store for years, jicama season. Let me tell you, it was good, you know.
Now, Lisa, I want to talk for a minute about supermarkets, because I've been reading a lot of food policy books lately, and I recently learned that supermarkets were actually a patented entity at the beginning of the 19th century, mm-hmm. and that as consumers, we were all trained how to shop in them. That switch from the general store, mm-hmm. where somebody was behind the counter and knew what everything was, and the consumer went up and asked for each thing, so right. It was driven. You weren't put through a maze and sold all these things that were exploding in front of your face that you didn't need. Talk to me a little bit about what you feel about supermarkets and impediments to being able to replicate this. Why don't we have one here in Los Angeles? How could it happen?
I think I believe that the problem is not food production. I believe the food's all out there. I think the whole thing has to do with how stores treat their employees, how they train their employees, how they think of their employees in the supermarket setting. I believe, and this just may be my, you know, fantasy, that the food business, the mainstream food business, is full of people who would love to bust out and sell some product and be rock stars, you know, and do it. But the supermarket system has devolved into kind of almost a Soviet, you know. I mean, I've asked Bill to explain this to me many times, because I couldn't understand the idea of a store not wanting to sell more of something. You know, he says, no, believe me, they don't want to. They want to sell their target number, the number they predicted, not more and not less.
Because you always want to have something on the shelf? You don't want the shelf to be empty?
Because a lot of these stores are being run from, like, safely from Phoenix, and you know, you have centralization, you know, when it becomes sometimes the, you know, who's leading this horse, the tail or the head, and kind of thing.
When we were backstage earlier, the two of you were talking about a trip that you took to Turkey. And just to give a little bit of a global spin on retailing beautiful product, could you describe what you saw in the produce markets there?
Well, when you go to a country or street market, any street market in Europe or anywhere, it's seasonal, and they're all selling the same thing because the same products are in season. The products are beautiful because the competition is there, but it's also seasonal. If you wait 2 weeks and come back, you know, there will be a different product mix. You know, Puntarella disappears and something else starts up. And you know, mushrooms come and go. So when we were in Turkey, we went to the wholesale market, and Turkey is, what did you say, 16 million people?
Istanbul is the largest city in Europe.
We went to Istanbul.
They're feeding 16 million people out of this.
And the product list was not that great, but the quality was extraordinary. And there were many vendors, right? And
we couldn't even see the extent of it. I think it must have been hundreds and hundreds.
Do you think that an impediment might be that we're not such a homogenous society?
The store I work in, Berkeley, is a very, very international community. It's as cosmopolitan as any I've ever seen. In fact, it's that nature that allows us to be as the store we are.
I think it's a great strength in California agriculture.
Absolutely.
Given the situation we're in right now, the fact that we have people from all over the world moving here constantly with ideas, different tastes, it just makes the base wider. It means that there's more potential channels for opportunity.
As farmers as well as
farmers
eaters.
And as retailers, I think it always helps. And also, anybody who's coming here who still cooks, you know... Well, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Where the bonds are still there, that's...
So let me bring Paul into this conversation before we go to questions. When you immersed yourself in this economic study of the food system, which is heating up, as you say, which I think is a very kind way of saying that a system that's constantly breaking, what do you see as points of light, so to speak, like the one that Lisa has captured in terms of the Fujimoto story?
Well, I mean, I've just learned a lot just, you know, listening tonight and when I've watched the film. So it's that kind of new information kind of coming from an unexpected quarter. I mean, if you think about it, we get our food information from some pretty set sources. And a lot of times the debate is framed by the major stakeholders, you know, the supermarkets, the policymakers. And a lot of the discussion is, it's not even framed as discussion, it's just advertising. It's just their presence. I mean, you go to a supermarket, and that's the best advertisement they could ask for. There's this massive store with an endless and never-ending supply. And it's tough to break out of that and think that there could be an alternative. And so when you see something like this and you see that it works and that, you know, he's making a living, that's great. You see this all, I'm assuming.
Yes.
But the need for examples like that is critical. Because, again, the dominant model is so dominant at so many levels that it's easy to think that alternatives are just, they're just freaks. They could only exist in Berkeley. And, you know, and just to write them off as this fluke, and the rest of us are going to have to deal with whatever. So I think the more examples we can get, the better. And I think the fact that, you know, they talk about the food industry being in the control of a handful of companies. You know, three companies control most of the meat production. You can go down the line, and it's really depressing. And they also control the ideas about food and the debate. And so the fact is, though, that there are, you know, 280 million consumers in this country, many of whom have their own ideas about what they want to eat. There are, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of farmers. And it used to be that everyone sort of ran an experiment on their own farm. Because we didn't have the internet, we didn't have instant communication, you were forced to come up with your own ideas. Now we do have the internet. And the idea that we could bring those two forces together, you know, where we could have tens of thousands of experiments running, I think that's really encouraging. Now that's not what the industry wants to see, because they would lose control. But that's what's going to have to happen, and I'm seeing more and more of that. There are some cautionary notes, though, that I think that really have to be thought about, and that is, we can't be purists. I don't think we have the luxury anymore of being purists. You know, the organic movement is very strong, but it's very hard to scale that up for reasons that you can probably imagine. It's tough to find that much manure. I mean, right now we're swimming in an ocean of manure, but if you were to try to produce all our food organically, you'd run into some challenges, not insurmountable, but
And I think the other thing is, you know, I know farmers up in Washington State, wheat farmers, who are growing wheat in a new and, I believe, sustainable way. They're taking very good care of their soil, and they're coming up with they're looking for varieties that actually have a higher nutritional content. But they're also they're reserving the right to use a little synthetic nitrogen fertilizer and a little synthetic pesticide. Now, they don't qualify for organic, so they don't get the price premium. And they get the cold shoulder from many in the organic community. And yet, they're coming up with something that, in the long run, they can feed a lot of people, and it's more sustainable than the conventional model. So I think we have to be open to some of these ideas. Now, we have to be critical. We can't just, comes in and says, I can design you a super tomato by altering the genes. Well, there's reason to be skeptical about that. But I think that going forward, the stakes are too high and the numbers are too large for us to insist on absolute perfection. I mean, I think, the perfect is the enemy of the good, and I think food is a really good case in point. So I see a lot of possibilities, but I also see the need for an open mind.
That's a good place to start with questions. Do I have a question? Right here, this gentleman here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had two kind of related questions. The one is your take on organics in the supermarkets, because I know that a lot of the supermarkets are expanding that line. And the other is, how in the world do they manage to sell grapes for 69 cents a pound that come all the way from Chile?
Yeah, Paul. Paul, definitely the 69-cent grapes.
Yeah. Well, someone made a point in a book about Walmart, I think, that you could buy salmon from Chile cheaper than you could mail it back to them. So, they're bringing it in mass. And this food model that we've built, this global sourcing system, and Bill's point about how seasonality, well, we've been divorced from that idea, because the problem with seasonality is you stop buying. And supermarkets have realized that if they keep produce on the shelves, you'll buy it for as long as it's there, even if the strawberries taste like wood. So they've traded off this idea. But the cost of that is that you have to develop a global sourcing where, as soon as the season's done in Argentina, you move to Colombia, and you go around the globe doing that. Now, that model worked great, or it seemed to, when oil was $15 a barrel. Now it's at almost 10 times that level. And so, in order to make that system continue to work, the distribution companies have to look farther afield for cheaper ways to lower costs, which again is how we end up in places like China. So the question is, how much longer can we continue to have those 69-cent grapes? In many cases, produce is a loss leader. It's what grocery stores will lose money on in order to bring you in. How much longer they can continue to lose the money they're obviously losing now is a good question. But I think we may see year-round produce only in places like Whole Foods. So I think it's going to be something that sort of fades away.
Lisa, do you want to take the organic, the big scale organic question?
Big scale organic in the supermarket? What do you want to know? Just like my opinion, or
is it really organic, or how is it different from farmers market organic?
Well, I guess whether it's sustainable, whether you see it as progressive, or whether you see it as an attempt to industrialize what has been more of a grassroots movement.
Yes, and yes, and also, if there are inspectors and they're actually checking the production on these guys, that you can believe the pedigree, it does mean that there's less pesticides being used someplace out there. And most things you have to be more careful to be able to grow them to a high degree of quality organically. So it just means they're paying better, they're just watching out better and being more careful. So I think that's kind of good. I think the question of scale pervades this entire business. Everything. Paul, did you not encounter the scale thing every place you turned, and it changes everything? Kind of.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, if you're driving down costs, the more units you can pump through your system, the more you can spread your costs over each unit and lower your per unit cost. And that just becomes the mantra, regardless of what it's doing to the quality of the good. And I think the organic thing is going to be a really interesting test, because we've gone from a market where there's still just 2, maybe 3%, depending on the market you're looking at, is organic. And at that small scale, the organic industry has some flexibility. It can charge a 10 to 20% premium, and it doesn't have a huge amount of competition. If organic Walmart, the Walmart model is to come in there and just say, well, we'll just make organic at the same farms we were making the other stuff, but we'll just turn the switch. We'll just, you know, go from synthetic to organic. And I think then they'll start running, if we actually boost it, they'll start running into some constraints on resource. Again, it's not just manure. It's, you know, if you're going to use cover crops and refertilize your soil by, you know, with cover crops, then you're not growing corn. You know, you're growing, you're using some legume, okay? So then you're taking corn out of production. And we've seen what happens when we take corn out of production to feed it to ethanol plants. So it can be done, but really what it all comes down to, I mean, it comes down to a question of meat. And this, I think, is the starting to dawn on people, is you can't have a sustainable system that's global and sustainable and fair and continue to consume as much meat as we do in this country. I know we were just talking about produce, but really what we're talking about is acres.
No, meat drives, because the whole system's interrelated, meat drives a lot of what's happening in the rest of the sectors as well, because there's competition for resources.
And that's because the meat, before it's meat, eats grain.
Yes.
So Paul, give us how many pounds of grain to create not just the animal, the bulk of the animal, but the steak.
Yes,
the
so
actual
this is
carved out steak.
This is an important distinction, because they don't want you to hear this. It's so secret. Okay, so the ratio they give you is it's an average of about 4 pounds of grain to make a pound of meat average. But that's live weight. That's the animal with intact. Once you've taken away all the things you're not going to eat, or that most of us wouldn't eat, it's about 8 to 9 pounds of grain per pound of meat. That's average. So it goes from chicken, which is 4, up to beef, which is 20. So you think about it, you know, and then you think, well, it takes about 1,000 pounds of water to make a pound of grain. And then you start doing the math, and it's like, wow. Okay, so if there are going to be another 4 billion people on the planet, and most of these newcomers will be in the developing world where diets are still catching up with ours, you know, what exactly does that mean? You know, and are we going to call up Beijing and say, by the way, you know, could you slow down the reproduction, and could you not eat as much meat as we already do? I mean, you know, it's the same thing as happened in the energy sector. We've learned that our, you know, completely irresponsible energy use has created these massive environmental problems, and now we're looking at China and India and saying, could you just skip that part of your economic development? Well, we're kind of returning to China and India and suggesting that they do the same thing with their dietary development, and it's going to be a very tough policy question.
Right here. Hold that thought.
Oh, hi. Bill, reflect if you would on the grower's perspective on genetically modified foods. And Paul, how do you reconcile the resistance to genetically modified foods with what sounds like an oncoming food crisis?
Well, the grower's perspective to genetically modified food is the growers I deal with are simply it's always about taste and production, and for myself, the powers that be, Monsanto, whomever, when they start developing new products, it's not for flavor, it's for fungicide resistant, for pest resistant, for production, for yield, for foreground color. If it's a peach, you want it to be red at the beginning, you want it to be low acid, you want it to be, you know, these kind of things. All those things don't exactly match up to what we're always trying to produce, and that, just after saying that, there are, I can't say I know of, I know of a lot of products that are newly developed fruit that are better, but I don't believe any of them are genetically modified. That they're all, you know, this kind of Mendel bred breeding. But there's no doubt for like in grains and things like that, you know, if you can raise your production, like in corns, if you can raise your production, who am I to say to a farmer that you shouldn't ought to do that? Except, of course, you know, the background where Monsanto comes back and withholds your seed after changing the market.
The legal department.
When they're copywriting seed.
So anyway, that's my take. I haven't found any GMO products
tasted really great.
Because it's not taste that they're trying to develop. It's production.
And also from the eater's point of view, don't you feel that labeling is sort of the biggest issue, that people should have a choice to not choose that?
Absolutely. The European Union requires labeling, and people preferentially choose, you know, regardless of price, are preferentially choosing non-GMO products, and it's clear. It's clear.
Paul.
Well, until food gets more expensive, you know.
Right. like day after tomorrow, then we'll all. Well, you know, it's interesting because the food crisis has kind of provided this opportunity for the industry and a lot of supporters to say, well, now is GM's golden moment, because clearly with food becoming scarce and with traditional breeding methods not meeting current demand and certainly not future demand, then you guys are going to have to get over your objections to GM. And I think that argument needs to be taken very seriously, because we are facing serious constraints on all kinds of many of the resources that go into making food. That said, GM is not. Then let's set aside the safety and environmental concerns. I know it may be impossible, but you know, to me, the biggest risk about GM is that they won't be used for what people say they're going to be used for. Right now, Monsanto and its competitors are saying, you know, we can produce, we can raise yields by 50%. We can create these crops that will tolerate salty soils. We can create crops that will require less water and less nitrogen fertilizer. Now, all that sounds wonderful, particularly now that those resources are constrained, but the truth is that they've had very little luck coming up with any of those. The two most successful commercial, almost the only commercial GM crops are BT. It secretes its own pesticide, and Roundup resistant soybeans, corn, and some of the other crops. Now, what's critical to note about these is that these genetic modifications were one or two traits, which in the world of genetic modification is like child's play. When they're talking about yield, think what yield is. If you're going to increase the yield of a plant, you're manipulating its reproduction, essentially. That's what yield is about, its seeds. And reproduction requires every skill that a plant has: its capacity to resist insect attack, its capacity to deal with moisture changes, temperature, light, everything. And we're talking not hundreds, but thousands of traits. And that's a huge task, which is one main reason why when they've come up with these yield increases that are through genetic modification, and they work in the lab, as soon as they take the plant out to the real world, it doesn't make it, because it doesn't have the hardiness that a plant that's developed over, you know, the millennium does. Now, is it possible that they'll be able to break through the yield barrier with genetic modification? Possibly. But it will take them years, and that won't give them a good return on investment. So really what they're interested in doing is focusing on the crops that will make them a lot of money, which is Roundup Ready corn and soybeans, and cotton and wheat. And that's it. That's four crops. And those are mainly grown by large commercial farmers in North and South America. They're not interested in the 3/4 of the world's farming population that live in the developing world and can't afford or would even want to grow Roundup Ready soybeans. So that, to me, is the real obstacle to GM. We're talking about saving the world, but really what we want to do is continue selling what we've always sold to the farmers we've always sold to.
Herbicides.
Right.
We have time for maybe one, maybe two more questions. Right here, right behind you.
This is actually a comment on the question about commercial scale organics, which is that if the Grimway Corporation is out there and they're growing 5,000 acres of organic carrots, then they're putting out of business God knows how many 20-acre farmers, and that would be my objection to that's kind of industrialized organic.
Up here.
Hi, I have a question for Bill. I was wondering, why is it that when I go to the Korean market, I can get certain produce at about half or maybe even a quarter of the price of the same produce at a regular Ralph's or other kind of supermarket? And these are products that are not especially products that Koreans love to eat, like a red bell pepper or a portobello mushroom.
Well, let's see, where do I start? Yes, you can probably do that because they're buying the Koreans like myself are a little more quick. Koreans, meaning small independents, are a little more quick-footed, and are getting overages. That is, you know, they're getting on the spot market. They're getting deals, and compared to Ralph's, which has to contract to buy 24 truckloads of 25 pallets or 26 pallets each. And so there's this market level, and then there are deals, and deals abound. On the other hand, there are products that will go through, like in vegetables especially, there are products which go through contracted small farms, local small farms, just like we're talking about, but are not, that are commercial, and are done in quantity and leave out packing sheds and everything, and so you can get them cheaper. And also, they're working on a smaller margin. Their labor costs are much lower.
Lisa,
yeah.
Is there going to be a screening of the film here in Southern California?
Yesterday.
are you planning any future?
That was all I could afford.
and was it sold? Did you get a good group of people?
Yeah, a fantastic group of people. It's always fun to watch this movie in a group. It's
to work on getting another.
I'm open. You know, if you ever get the kitchen open over there, if Pompeii ever gets that Hollywood, I would love to do it there.
No, I'm on that board too.
I know that. Yeah,
oh, boy,
you see,
that's
me.
Interesting.
This is me lobbying you right here in front of everyone.
Before we wrap up, and I say thank you to everyone, I just wanted to mention that at the beginning, Louise said I'm on the Board of Overseers of the Chefs Collaborative 2000. I'm no longer doing that. Instead, I'm on the Stewardship Council of Roots of Change, which is a very interesting organization that's very hard to describe. But basically, it's a funding organization that is seeking, as its mission, is a sustainable food system in California by the year 2030. We're working with all kinds of groups and farmers and the government of the state of California to make that possible by getting people to sit at the table and starting to craft small bits of legislation. If you'd like to become involved or you'd like to learn about Roots of Change, outside where Paul is going to be signing books, I have a little flyer that will direct you to a website and you can learn about it. I would like to thank you. This is the kind of discussion that we could sit here for another 4 hours if we could break for food. And continue. I'd like to thank Lisa for her really extraordinary work on a very compelling subject, Mr. Bill Fujimoto. Thank you for your passion. We all need little injections of that. And Paul, you're really absolutely brilliant and compelling study of a crisis that's really coming to hit home right now.
Thanks.
And thank you to the Central Library and Aloud Louise for bringing us all together. I really appreciate it.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.